she couldn't make herself eat, even though she wanted to. That's pretty well when we realised we had a problem on our hands.
Once we get into the time spent, the travel, across the year, I lose over 80 hours of paid work just accessing treatment.
2.8 million people in 2023 had or has had an eating disorder in their lifetime.
The cost of going to hospital was so much money that without them, there is no chance. I probably wouldn't be here today because I would not be able to afford that individually.
Our whole life was basically trying to get Sophie well somehow.
A company that has 100 staff, on average, they're losing more than $44,000 a year due to eating disorders or caring for eating disorders among their staff.
If there's one thing that gets the attention of our politicians, it's money. It's one of the big motivators of politics around the world. That's not a secret. It's not even controversial. For the past 4 years, we've been singing from the rafters on this podcast about the need for governments to put more resources into preventing and treating eating disorders. And now, thanks to a comprehensive national survey from Butterfly and Deloitte, we can give them a very good reason.
$67 billion per year is the cost to the people of Australia and our economy.
That's a lot of money. This is Butterfly Let's Talk. I'm Sam Eichen, and this is Butterfly's CEO, Jim Hungerford. He's only been in the job for around 6 months, but he's hit the ground running. He says quantifying the problem on a national level was well overdue.
There was an earlier report in 2012. Since then, the cost of eating disorders has increased 36% in real terms, so after adjusting for inflation.
This report shows what we already knew. The cost of eating disorders is devastating. But it's not just an economic cost. It's the social impact can't be understated.
The biggest parts are really the impact on the individual and the family. But there's also huge impacts on productivity that is borne by employers. There's, of course, all the health expenditure that goes in. So this is a massive impact that affects all of us, really. And then when you compare that to the amount of money that's spent to prevent eating disorders or to support people who do develop them, that amount of money is minuscule.
The crippling impact of an eating disorder goes far further than the individual experiencing the behaviours. It's also huge for parents, carers, other family members and friends. The ripple effect is significant.
Sophie, our daughter, went away to boarding school up in Toowoomba in Queensland. My name is Scott McCanch. I live in rural New South Wales. I have a farm there and three children, the eldest of whom developed an eating disorder in her early teens, and I guess that's why I'm here. She's always been a very sporty kid and loved playing everything from netball, touch football, any ball sport she could lay her hands on. And so she threw herself into everything and was really enjoying it. She was seemed perfectly happy. Everything was fine. She was loving life and everything was going well. She'd fitted into school and was loving everything, but it was just the weight wasn't a good thing. And we started trying to turn it around a bit ourselves then. But it just slowly progressed. At about the age of sort of 16, we realised that this was getting pretty serious when we started speaking to her coaches and whatever, and realised she was training about 12 times a week for different sports and whatever, and was just living on basically a salad bar at the boarding house because she was trying to keep herself in peak condition.
Before we let Scott continue on his story, there was another significant development that we need to bring in now from this report, and that is a startling change in the age of the onset of eating disorders.
Something that really surprised me is that the typical age of onset has become much younger over the last 12 years. So back in 2012, the people with the highest incidence of eating disorders were young adults aged 20 to 24. Now, the people with the highest incidence are teenagers aged 15 to 19. And I think that 5 years earlier onset, you know, and when you think about that time of your life and all of the social pressures that are affecting you then, and especially these days with social media, all of the school pressures, everything that happens, you can understand why it's occurring then. But it is such a concern that we have these young people who are developing sometimes, as we all know, incredibly impactful conditions that can change the rest of their life.
Now let's get back to Scott. He was telling us about his concerns about his daughter's disordered eating. And the first port of call for him was a dietitian.
They went through a diet and basically said, you're doing the right thing restricting, you're just restricting the wrong foods, which is not, in hindsight, not a good thing to tell someone who actually has an eating disorder. Admittedly, the dietitian didn't realise that they had an eating disorder at that stage. Then we sort of started thinking, okay, this is a little bit more serious. And especially when she got to a point when she did realise that it was the lack of food that was causing the decrease in her performance. But at that point, she couldn't make herself eat, even though she wanted to. And that's pretty well when we realised we had a problem on our hands.
Desperate to find help for his daughter, Scott took her to see a veritable cascade of GPs and psychologists, psychiatrists, other dietitians, driving for hours at a time to get there. And remember, this was all during her final few years of high school.
In year 12, we just ended up having to pull her out of school because she'd just completely crashed. Her eating disorder had morphed, changed from sort of anorexia into a night eating disorder, which then developed into binge eating. And we brought her home then and just continued to try and find a psychologist or someone, anyone that could help. And finally, we managed to find a dietitian down in Tamworth who was a godsend. It started to look like we had a light at the end of the tunnel. That's something we thought we had a at least a path to follow. Up until that point, we were completely in the dark. No one we'd come across had really had any experience with it, knew what to do, knew where to go. It basically took over the whole family. My wife and I, our whole life was basically trying to get Sophie well somehow, or find some way to get her well to start with. And because of that, our two boys, they didn't get anywhere near the attention they needed as children as well, because we were so totally focused on trying to sort this issue out.
From there, Scott was able to find a great psychologist within a 2-hour drive of home, which for him is reasonably close when you live in the bush. Sophie's road to recovery became just a little bit clearer. Add to that, bearing and worrying about economic and psychosocial costs to his family, it's exhausting. But Butterfly's new report clearly shows that Scott and his family were far from alone. Another significant piece of information from this report shows us that he needn't have felt like that. An alarming increase in the prevalence and the cost of eating disorders. 1.1 million Australians now live with an eating disorder.
On top of that, 1.7 million people had an eating disorder in their lifetime in 2023. So if you add those together, that's actually saying 2.8 million people in 2023 had or has had an eating disorder in their lifetime. I'm Simone Chung. I'm a partner in Deloitte Access Economics. I specialize primarily in health and human services. I like to describe what I do as measuring the immeasurable, using data and evidence to actually shed light and make policies better in health and social care. the way that we calculate these economic costs is really we look at the number of people, so prevalence, number of people that have an eating disorder. We look at the impacts that people have or people face with an eating disorder. So this could be that they need access to healthcare services, or they need informal care by families and friends. And they also have impacts around their quality of life or well-being. And so we look at how many people, what are the impacts, and then we put a dollar value on those impacts, essentially.
Simone also found that it's costing people more to find the help that they need.
Costs have increased by 36% since 2012, and part of that has been driven by an increase in use of healthcare services, and part of that is an increase in understanding of eating disorders and the healthcare services that they need and require for recovery. So things like residential care, etc., has been more available than previous.
So as prevalence of eating disorders is increasing and awareness is growing, more people are seeking treatment since 2012, and that's a good thing. But for ordinary individuals, the costs around care are just too high.
The costs of my eating disorder takes up about 20% of my annual income. And this is even with Medicare rebates and private health insurance.
This is Chantelle, and like a lot of our lived experience guests, they've been through a long and arduous journey with an eating disorder.
My first real memory of disordered eating and body image issues are as young as 9 or 10. I was a dancer and I was quite active, but my body was just different from everyone else. I was just built differently, and I never really thought much of it until I started noticing the way other people spoke about my body and the way it was received and perceived and described. I was never really able to receive any formal support or a diagnosis, even though I was in inpatient care as well. Later on in my teens, I ended up in an inpatient mental health facility. And even though I was talking about it openly with my therapist and in group therapy about a lot of the dangerous habits I was engaging in, I'm not really sure why, but it wasn't really received as something that urgently needed to be addressed. And I feel like it was a little bit dismissed as part of, like, you know, a natural experience of, you know, the puberty experience. And a lot of the times when I really thought that I had made it through and I was out the other side, I actually took a step back and realized that I was still quite deep in the eating disorder. I just had taken on a new form. And that's happened a few times, and I've really had to do a lot of work to keep myself accountable and really make sure I'm being open and honest about where I'm at.
For Chantelle, just keeping in touch with their treatment team is really squeezing them financially.
Just accessing a therapist with fortnightly sessions and quarterly psychiatrist sessions to manage my medication, quarterly dietitian sessions, that runs up $11,738.90 annually. Wow. And that's like, that doesn't even factor in. That's just those sessions. Once we get into the time spent, the travel across the year, I lose over 80 hours of paid work just accessing treatment. And so that equates to $3,400 in lost wages. Once you include travel costs, that adds another $1,200 to the bill, bringing the total cost to $16,338.90. That's $314.20 a week, and I'm not even accessing all the treatment that I need.
Those sort of expenses have a huge impact on someone's life, but the cost to the individual or family is just the start.
Now having current information, really being able to talk about what is the impact on Australian society right now, that makes the biggest difference. But also, there's been a lot of methodological improvements between the two reports, just as everything moves on. So we're able to speak with a lot more confidence about how much the effects are. One example, which isn't really a government example, but much more for society. Employers, a company that has 100 staff, on average, they're losing more than $44,000 a year due to eating disorders or caring for eating disorders among their staff. It's really important for employers to be able to provide the right supports for their staff who might have or might be caring for somebody with an eating disorder to ensure that that goes as well as possible so that their person can stay and flourish within the workplace.
As Jim told us earlier, the report found that the economic and social cost of eating disorders has grown to $67 billion in 2023. $67 billion.
So it's $67 billion over the 1.1 million people, which means on average it's costing each person with an eating disorder $60,000. Or around $61,000.
And so does that mean each person with an eating disorder is essentially has a bill of $60,700 per person, or is a lot of that picked up by our health system, for example?
It is a bill, but it's being paid for by different people. So some of that is being borne by individuals, some of that is being paid for by government through healthcare, some of it is lost productivity for carers in time that they've spent caring for someone with an eating disorder.
Holy dooly, that is huge.
$251 million of that is health system costs, and this includes anything from, you know, medication, pharmaceuticals to healthcare services, allied health, etc. There are some other costs, but by far the largest cost component is the loss in well-being. So basically loss in well-being for individuals who are living with an eating disorder. Then the second highest is productivity. And this is because eating disorders, as we have looked at, affect younger people more and people who are in working age population, so 15 to 65 year olds. And so we're seeing productivity costs as part of that total cost being almost 27%. Almost $18 billion is in productivity losses.
One of the key takeaways from the report is that eating disorders are coming on younger. We spoke about that earlier. That means they're happening frequently when people are in high school or in early stages of their career. The years that kind of set you up for life.
And I'd gone to England and tried to have somewhat of a normal social working life. And it just was not possible when you're suffering from an eating disorder. Every part of your life is dictated by that, dictated by the decisions that you can make.
Tim's eating disorder started when he was 21 and is complicated by a diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder. He thought that a move abroad might help.
Being so sick at the time, I couldn't make those decisions. I was working 14-hour shifts somehow, and it just impacted me. I had to come home, and I got an emergency flight home, went straight into hospital. Even after those hospital admissions, I was riddled with fear of people seeing me how I was, because I was quite sick. So I'd just become a recluse. When I could work, it was short 2-hour shifts, just because I didn't have the energy to be able to go through with a full working day.
Even though he was a young adult at the time, Tim's parents stepped up and shouldered a lot of the burden to help him get better.
My parents have always been people that say, if you're sick, you better to get the care. Now they've always thrown money at everything I've needed, and I've needed many things, flying to Brisbane for treatment, for OCD and everything like that. I'm one of the lucky ones, the small percentage that have been able to have the financial backing of their main supporters to be able to go in, even though that was accounted for. The financial burden, that the cost of going to hospital was so much money that without them, there is no chance. I probably wouldn't be here today, because I would not be able to afford that individually.
Are they amazing parents? The parents who stand by people through this, the toll that they, well, I guess the cost to them is more than just financial as well.
No, I think your first word was perfect. It was toll. I saw what it did to my parents. And that was another influencing factor on me getting better. Just seeing my parents worn down. And the first time my dad saw me when he came over to England, he just started crying. He wouldn't talk to me. My brother couldn't see me, look at me when I came back from England. The emotional toll it took on everyone, even my friends, my relationships was really, really tough. And I can't thank everyone in my support network enough for standing by me and believing in me to get better. You lose friendships because you become very flaky. I became very flaky with going out and socializing, and everyone's trying to live a normal life. And they can't always keep up with a bloke that's just sort of not willing to come out. So my relationships sort of all but mended, trying to have a romantic life in the middle of an eating disorder just didn't happen. But now that's perfect. I'm getting married in 2 months. So that's all fixed. I was fortunate enough to be on a really good road to recovery before my dad died. And he was very, very happy that I'd made that extra work. And it even when he died, he said he was so proud of me. It was one of the worst, the last words he said to me. So that will always keep me going. And I have no intention on ever going back because life is so good now.
God, sorry, you've thrown me. That was...
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I think it's lovely that you got to share that moment with him. Here's a few other significant figures for you before we wrap up this story. Women are twice as likely as men to experience an eating disorder, and less than one in three, 30% of those with eating disorders, actually go and seek help. So if we've got so many people out there who aren't going to seek help or aren't telling anybody that they have an eating disorder, is there a portion of the population that's being missed?
The figures are really an underestimate of the real extent of the problem. The reason for that is twofold. One of which is we know that less than a third of people with eating disorders actually reach out for help. And so as a result of that, all of the effort that gets put into support and treatment and things like that, really, there should be three times as much being spent on that area there. And then similarly, because of the fact that it's behind the scenes, all of the, and we haven't done a proper Australian-wide prevalence study, all of those estimates about, well, given we have to multiply everything by three, and then we've got to think, well, if only people were reaching out, getting support, we would do this, et cetera. All of those estimates, I believe, are significant underestimates of the real depth of the problem.
All of the data is based on existing data that's already being in the system. And so to that extent, it's as reliable as the data is to us. One of the things that we have found around the data is it is still patchy when you break down by the different types of eating disorders. So when we think about eating disorder types, we tend to think about mostly anorexia and bulimia, which are readily available in our health system data sets. Once we get into binge eating disorders, ARFID, OSFID, UFID, etc., the data, when you break it down into those conditions, gets more patchy.
Now, if you don't know what those acronyms mean yet, ARFID is Avoidant Restrictive Eating Disorder, OSFED is Other Specified Feeding and Eating Disorder, and UFED is Unspecified Feeding and Eating Disorder. There are so many different kinds of eating disorders, and if you go to the Butterfly website, you can find out a little bit more information on all of them. So now that we have a reasonably good idea that this is a pretty big problem and it's getting worse, what can we do with this information?
What we're calling for is to maintain the effort that the government's putting in on therapy and treatment, the support for the residentials, things like that, but the desperate need to hugely increase the amount of money they invest into prevention. So we're calling for the government to have recurrent funding, so each year to spend $12 million on prevention. So that's less than 5% of the direct cost, the health costs that the government pays out. But it will pay back so hugely by reducing the number of people with eating disorders in the future. And so we've never been funded for for our health promotion work that we do in the community. We have received some funds for the school programs we run, but much more needs to be done. And whether it's done by Butterfly or by the other sector partners, we're just desperate for the government to get behind that and really support this significant increase in spend.
Politicians really need to understand the responsibility that they have, and I'm sure that they understand the power that they yield in terms of what policies and legislation they can put forward. But like, they have more responsibility to their current constituents. They also have responsibility to the future constituents, because, you know, the impacts that we're seeing right now in terms of the cost of living crisis and the housing crisis, that is policy from like 10 years ago. So the policy that people are enacting now might not have a huge impact on people today, but it will impact their children and their grandchildren.
A lot of people don't really understand what an eating disorder is and who the main groups are that are affected by it. And so I think it's just, they have to just get out there and talk to people who have been there, who know about it, so they can educate themselves, so that then they can sort of start making some good plans to help these people, because they're really struggling, especially in rural Australia, to get the help they need at the moment. And it's a long, hard road, and it's much longer than it needs to be. It has got a fairly slow decline down into it, and if it can be picked up quickly in that state of decline, things can be turned around fairly quickly, I'd imagine. If it's years before you get a diagnosis and some path for treatment, the eating disorder has such a hold on the person that it's really hard and time-consuming to turn it around.
If you'd like to have a look at the report yourself, it's on the Butterfly website. If you go to butterfly.org.au, you'll be able to click through all the links and find the full report and all of the data. For support or to find out more about eating disorders, the best first step to take is to reach out to the Butterfly helpline. It's 1-800-334-673. That's 1-800-ED-HOPE. There are also heaps of online resources as well if you just want to find out a little bit more about eating disorders or see what kind of prevention programs are available. Butterfly.org.au is the website. And that's all we have time for in this episode. Butterfly Let's Talk is produced by Icon Media for the Butterfly Foundation with the support of Waratah Education Foundation. Our executive producer is Camilla Beckett. We have lived experience support from Kate Mulray. Editing, general production, and hosting is done by me. I'm Sam Eichen. And if you'd like to support us in any way, the best thing that you can do is share this podcast with a friend or write us a review in the app that you're listening to right now. I'm Sam Eichen. Thank you so much for your company.